Hey folks, my name is Mikkel. I'm the Director of Communication in ContractBook. I'm really pleased that you decided to give this podcast a chance, and I hope that you enjoyed the jingle. It's called Liberty March, and it was one of the most patriotic and stereotypical American jingles I was able to find online. Because today we're going to explore how European tech companies, companies like ContractBook, can lead a successful expansion to the US market and gain a solid foothold in the promised land. In the past weeks, we have produced a short article series on this subject. We've discussed how European tech companies can Americanize their brand, how you get the timing right, what are the legal aspects of expanding, and where do you place your headquarters? Much more. Well, and why is ContractBook interested in that, you may ask? Well, first of all, we are in the middle of a US expansion ourselves, so we have a lot to learn. And secondly, and to be just completely transparent, ContractBook has an amazing tool for high growth tech companies that needs to scale their legal operations. And it is our hope that this content will work sort of like a bait and make some of you interested in how we may automate your legal work and get you set up in a safe and efficient manner while and before you scale your company. But enough about us. The point is that we are not natural experts in all aspects of this subject. We are also in a learning phase, and that's why we team up with a bunch of people who know way more than us. We've talked to some good people in UiPath, we've talked to VCs, PR companies, banks, law firms, and much more. One of the most interesting sources for our article series was Joanne Farquharson. She is the CEO of a consultancy called Foothold in America, and they help European companies get foothold in America. And I think her contribution to the article series was both very insightful and very well communicated. So I invited her to join this podcast. I hope you will enjoy it and you get a chance to learn more about when to expand, when you need help, what you can do on your own, and especially what you must do to prepare your business legally. I promise you that there will be lots of hands-on advice that you can work with directly in your business. So, peeps. Enjoy. So, I mean, this is an obvious question to begin this podcast. Could you present Foothold in America for me? What is it that you do?
Sure. So, in one line, we make it easy to expand in the US. So our role is to eliminate as much of the bureaucracy, the administration, the risk for clients, specifically around employing people, providing employee benefits, setting up their entities, and managing registrations in whatever states they're doing business.
Okay. And what is your role in all this?
So, I'm the CEO. Yeah. I was formerly the U.S. expansion advisor, official full-time employee number one, 3.5 years ago. And our parent company was a U.K. consulting company that decided to expand to the U.S. And they did that, realized it was difficult, realized they made mistakes, some of them more costly than others. And after they figured it out, they thought, oh, we can probably help some other UK life science companies come to the US. So it became a service of the consulting firm. And then it became clear, wow, there's a real opportunity throughout the UK, Europe, the world, in many professional industries to assist people. So we became our own entity, and the shareholders invested in me, and we have now grown to serving clients in, I think, 20 different countries and dozens of industries. And tech has emerged as one of the primary industries. So even through the pandemic, they just have been charging into the U.S., seeing an opportunity. And so we do a lot of work with tech companies.
Mm-hmm. Why is it so important for these European tech companies to have a presence in the US market?
In a word, because it's huge. It's the biggest market for both the overall economy and the tech market in general. Certain tech industries, specifically artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, things like that. They're just if you want to be successful, if you want to scale, you have to have some connection with the U.S. Whether that is your client base, your venture capital, your employees, your location. So it just you just really have to.
yeah, because I mean, one of the reasons would be for profits. But there's also like this like aura or something magical about the US. It really attracts tech companies. They must be there.
I think, you know what? It's funny. The US, I guess, maybe has a reputation, a history of being pioneering, independent. You know, maybe there's false bravado or a confidence there that I think is attractive to entrepreneurs. Even entrepreneurs from countries where you may not think of, you know, them being, every entrepreneur is a go-getter, really, but where the aspirations are global, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, some entrepreneurs, or, you know, maybe even a decade ago or so, were thinking, I'll build a profitable business, I can scale within my country, and that's fine. But it just seems like the DNA of a tech entrepreneur is to think of the world as the place to expand. There are no barriers. There are no borders when it comes to tech. So you want to go after things in a much bigger way than, you know, maybe some other industries. So that is one of the things that makes it so exciting to be living vicariously through so many, you know, with so many entrepreneurs by their side, just kind of going, wow, you know, they got this massive funding or even modest funding, and to watch the different decision-making processes that they go through to grow. And it's fascinating and something to be, it's a privilege to be kind of going alongside them. And maybe the same, it's the same for Contract Book, where you said, you know, that the tech that you provide is so necessary for other tech companies that we're in this together. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So like one of the things we've been a bit occupied with is that it seems like after a few years where at least Europe has had this reputation of lagging behind in tech and in the whole digital market, we see more and more European tech companies having success both in Europe, globally, and the US. They're getting more funding, and yeah, they're just sold at a higher valuation as well. Do you have an explanation for why that is? Why is European tech suddenly more successful than it used to be?
You know, that is such a good question. I wish I had an answer, because in some ways, maybe, I think the stereotypes, the images that we have of various countries in their culture, in the things that they're good at, there's probably some truth to it, but it's also never the full picture. So I can imagine that countries within Europe may think, the U.S. is big, so there must be a lot there, so maybe they're ahead of the game, and it's not necessarily the case. You'll find countries, cities that are their own hubs in tech, and I guess it's maybe just expanded. It's sort of, again, there are no borders. And this is maybe, I don't know if this, you know, how much this is an actuality or how much of this is just a perception of mine, is that in some ways the pandemic has taught us that the world, there are no borders. You may think there are, but there are not. And the other lesson I think I've seen our clients grab onto is that you can do a lot virtually, and you have to reach out beyond just your world to be successful. And for a while there, I thought, oh, this might be a bad thing for an organization like Foothold America, because we've always said, well, you need someone to be on the ground in the U.S. in order to be successful. And now we realize we can do so much business without actually getting on airplanes and things like that. There's, I mean, companies are closing Series B for $150 million and never met the investors. Mm-hmm. So it's, on one hand, it's maybe become easier to see ourselves all in this together, that, you know, yes, I can be from Copenhagen and, you know, and take on LA, and absolutely I expect to be at the same table. And so, yeah, I think, I don't know what the cause of it is, but I absolutely see it. And if I were to take that same idea and apply it specifically to the U.S., it's very, very common for people to contact us and say, I need an office in New York. I need to be in Boston. I need to be in San Diego, San Francisco, because those are the hubs. So we think of those places and we think this is where it's happening. And the reality is it's happening in Austin, Texas, and in Raleigh, North Carolina. So perhaps that's a parallel where I don't, I think the businesses and the mentality of people in Austin and Chicago and Philadelphia and Raleigh is, hey, there's no reason why you can't be here and we can't be a player at the table. In fact, it's better to consider some of these emerging hubs or sort of secondary hubs because there's less competition for employees. There's, maybe a better quality of living, much less expense. So I think, yeah, tech is a brilliant industry for being able to say, hey, you know, I can have a seat at the table and I don't have to be New York. So
that's like the first hands-on advice you give here in this podcast, that, you know, look outside the usual hubs.
It is. It's so to give you an example, clients in Boston in the life science industry. So I mentioned our parent company expanded to the U.S. They went to Boston, life science hub. It's obvious, but it's so competitive for talent that when they have an interview, they have the offer letter ready. And they will decide at the moment, we want to make you this offer. Because if they wait, they won't get them. And so that's not to say you wouldn't run into the same thing in Raleigh, North Carolina. But it's, yeah, when you go to the hubs, it has something, they have something to offer for sure. There's a mature ecosystem there. And I wouldn't want to just plunk down anywhere in the U.S., but for sure, you can save quite a bit of money and you can find the talent. So going outside of the hubs it can make a lot of sense. And you do have to do your research. So and the other thing that can be challenging for European companies is that California is sometimes a place they want to be, but the time zone challenge is huge. So, I mean, I'm a big fan of the East Coast, just from a time zone perspective. If you think about how much you overlap time you have with your colleagues, it's minimal. And one of the things I think that clients or potential US expansion companies miss is the amount of engagement that they need to, the amount of effort they need to put into nurturing their US employees, because they will leave. You know, there are no long-term notice periods. So there's a very quick moving pace. And if they feel like you're not paying attention to them, you are, there's not room for advancement because maybe there are only one or two employees in the US, and then they'll be gone. So it takes a lot of effort to, or you need to invest a lot of effort in making sure they are engaged, they feel passionate about the product, they feel included in the team. And so, yeah, so that's a part of the look outside the hub.
Yeah. Kind of thing. So what, I mean, you mentioned that the tech market is becoming more global. That's definitely true. But what do you see as the most important differences between operating a tech startup in Europe and operating one in America?
So, hold on one second. So we touched on one of those differences in operating. And so it absolutely is about the employees, because you're not going to be successful without them. You have your tech. And we assume mm-hmm. that there's proof of concept, that it's something that, you know, you've been developing over time. But it's really the people and the amount of employee engagement. And it's very interesting, because people, I think, sometimes have a perception of, you know, Americans are work, 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 and they don't take much leave. They don't earn much leave. They want, you know, a high salary, they're going to check voicemail and email on the holidays and the weekends and things like that. And those things are true. And they do expect that you're going to give them the pat on the shoulder, that it's that they're going to be recognized, that they're going to be appreciated, that they're going to be included. And I wouldn't say that those things aren't true in Europe, but I do find that it catches clients off guard when they go, you know, my people are leaving, or even worse, they're not producing and they're staying. And so what is it that I'm missing? Why can't I get this fire or this performance that I need from these folks? It takes energy, and it also touches on cultural differences mm-hmm. because some, and this isn't just culture, it's really human, but you know, you've some people need very direct conversation, and you know, if you're not meeting the requirements, then it's got to be mapped out completely. But again, there's going to be probably some pushback. Well, you need to give me training, or, you know, those kinds of things. And it's subtle. It can also be just a language barrier. So when, you know, English is your second language and the American worker is very likely has only one language that they speak, it's, you know, those subtle miscommunications can put people off. But what you really want when you're going to the US is you want that core group to feel as connected as the core group you built in your home country. And it is like starting another business, except you're wanting these to mesh. So I would say that would be the primary difference, is the amount of energy it's going to take to be in the operating in the US.
Do you have any hacks or ideas for how to create this coherent culture, or is it just hard work?
It's, you know what it is? I think in some ways it's the softer skills. And I was one, if you talked to me 10 years ago, I was a bit more hard-nosed, where I thought, you know, hey, we're paying you. You're supposed to do a job. This is what we expect. We're a startup. We told you that this is going to be intense and the payoffs are going to be great, but you know, you need to endure. And I don't know if it's sort of what happens every generation is, you know, a new generation has an impact on the workplace, or if it's the world in general, where we are thinking, you know, maybe we need to take care of our planet a little bit more, those kinds of things. I think those things have to be built into a company, and this isn't just for the US, but I think sort of globally as well, is to say, this is what we stand for, this is what we're attempting to do, and we want people who understand this mission, are passionate about this mission, and we care about you. You are so important to us. That we, the leaders of this organization, are taking the time to make sure you're engaged. And I put far more time into that now than I have in previous businesses. It's the light bulb went off for me that it is about your team, and you can go nowhere without them. Mm-hmm. So it's just a lot more engagement than. It's not a nicety, it's a necessity.
So, you know, one thing is having softer skills, as you mentioned, and just being aware and communicative. But is there any way you can Americanize company culture to better suit American employees?
Ooh, it's a great question. And I find that clients each have to navigate their own their own philosophy about how they see the organization. Because on one hand, you want to marry the various international offices so that there's one goal and there's unity. On the other hand, you want to meet people where they live. So, you know, where what's important to you, you want to understand. So, for example, if you have maybe more junior staff who are looking in the American mindset of consumption. So I'm going to make this much money, and then I'm going to make this much money, and then I'm going to have a house and a car and then a better car. There's very much that that focus on consumption still in the US. And so you may be thinking, here's my culture from my home country. Everybody has 5 weeks of leave, and they expect that. But in the US, you may find, well, that's not actually as appreciated as $2,000 or $3,000 more or $10,000 or $15,000 more. And so there's a balance there for the organization to decide how much we're going to be one and the same, and how much we're going to recognize that there are cultural differences. So for Foothold America, so I'm in France now, that's where I live. We have a UK team and a US team. And for me, my personal philosophy is that I want to bring the best of both countries, in this case, the UK and the US. So our US employees have 5 weeks of leave. None of them have ever had 5 weeks of leave. We've had to push them to take all the leave. And I used to be like that. I would say, well, it's a bank holiday or it's a vacation. I'll take one extra day on either side and I'll get a little bit of time. Never would I take 2 weeks at once. And having lived in the UK for 5 years, I thought, oh, this is brilliant. Why would someone not take at least 2 weeks at one time? So for me, marrying the two was important. And now our US employees they're taking the time now and they're saying, oh, okay, yeah, this makes sense. I can come back refreshed and do a better job. And on the UK side, when I first arrived there, the salaries were so low compared to it. I was like, wow, some of these people have incredible experience and I can't believe that this is the salary. And so we pay an above average salary in the UK. So for me, it's just like, this is how we mesh the cultures. So to the degree that someone can do that, or a leader of a company decides or interprets their employee group as being open to that. So, you know, we are going to give you more leave. We believe in more leave, you know, that kind of thing may help. It's not so much Americanizing, but recognizing the American culture and having the impact that you want to have on it.
So it's not that I ask you to give, you know, sound legal advice in that sense, but you actually really need to create another employment contract.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, and even just to state this is that in the US, they're generally not referred to as employment contracts, and they're considered offer letters, and they are can have in many circumstances far less legalese. And you would think, America has a reputation for being litigious, and employees also, or disgruntled employees. And so wouldn't you want a tight contract? But the reality is it's more, you know, less promising in an offer letter. And it's so interesting because you may be, when you investigate U.S. employment, you'll come across the term at-will employment. And so what that feels like, or it's been communicated to me by European entrepreneurs, is it feels like, oh, this is easy. I can terminate them if I need to. And that's different than my country because, you know, we have to give a long period of notice, or, you know, it can be quite costly if you choose to dismiss someone. And so there's an appearance that it, you know, that it's easy to, you know, the offer letter might be more general, less legal. The at-will employment seems quite straightforward. And yet it's not that at all, because you can terminate an employee for any reason or no reason at any time without notice, unless it's a not legal reason for terminating someone. So, and there are protected classes. So believe it or not, the age of 40 or over is a protected class in the US. So that means if maybe an organization has several terminations and those people happen to be older than 40, then they could be running into trouble. One of those employees may say, wait a minute, seems like, you know, this is age discrimination, or, you know, there's a harassment situation or other kinds of discrimination. And then you can find yourself in, you know, on the bad side of a claim or a lawsuit coming at you. So it's a paradox in some ways, because you go, oh, offer letter and at-will employment, and yet we take great strains to let our clients know that you want to document performance, you need to be very careful with how you word these things, and so absolutely you are right.
So, yeah, so the legal systems in between America and the EU and the many different European jurisdictions, they're very, very different. So what does it mean for a young tech startup? Like, how much can they do themselves, research themselves, and how much would you advise them to seek advice? Like, how much can they set up legally for themselves?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first thing is it really depends on the culture of the company and the maybe the style of the founders. And that is, I've met many founders who are what I would call DIY. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, I've built the tech, I've built the company, I'm savvy, maybe I've studied business, maybe I haven't, I know how to use Google, I have a brain, I can figure these things out. And that's great. And there are others who come in with the mindset of, I don't know what I don't know. And even though I have this brilliant brain and I have done wonderful things, It's going to cost me my time, and more time, which time is money, to figure these things out. And so therefore, I'm going to find a trusted partner. The other piece of it is absolutely tax. You have to start with tax advice. And I don't mean tax advice from your home country advisor that, you know, has had a little bit of experience in the U.S. You absolutely want a U.S. tax advisor. Ideally, you'll find someone who knows both your home country and the U.S. And you really can find them. People are all over the place. You know? So it just it takes some work. But if you find you've got your home country tax folks and you find someone you feel comfortable with in the U.S., you have to be prepared for bringing these people together to you can't have separate conversations. You have to bring them together, and it takes a lot of coordination. But the tax is so important, even if you're not setting up a U.S. entity. So say you want to use an arrangement where, like Foothold America, for example, will serve as an employer of record. So you may want to test the waters, have an employee or two, but not set up a U.S. entity. You could still have a tax obligation based on your sales, based on the locations of your sales. So you do need tax advice. And then when it comes to the legal entity, you say, yes, we are going to set up a corporation here. You need tax advice to determine the type of entity that you want and, you know, how your accounting systems are going to work together. And that will differ when it comes to the goals of the company. So if you know your goal in 7 to 10 years is an IPO, then you may set up the entity and get all of the accounting systems in place and maybe not use an employer of record service. You go, we've got to do it from the ground up and make sure we do all the pieces, correctly. So it becomes quite the in-depth conversation. And that is one piece of advice I would give European tech entrepreneurs, is to come into the U.S. With the end in mind. What do you want from the U.S. market? How does that fit in your overall business objectives? And that will inform many of the decisions you make as you go. And you can come back to that core.
So what characterizes the tech startups that come to you, and what are the challenges that they have?
Great question. So if I were to think about the tech, UK and European tech companies that come to us, they fall into two different categories. One of them is the VC-backed, you know, maybe Series A, under a lot of pressure, scaling, has ample funds, but just huge, huge pressure. And the other types are those who have perhaps grown organically, have some clients in the U.S. and see it as an opportunity. They sort of have proof of concept already in the U.S. and they think we need to exploit this opportunity by doing X, Y, or Z. And that might be an entity, that might be employees, perhaps business development, or taking care of employees within the time zone. I'm sorry, taking care of clients in the time zones where they are. So those are the two types. And then if I were to take two types of entrepreneurs, you know, the folks that are going to do DIY, they'll go, I can Google it and figure it out. They maybe won't come to us. But the folks who come to us, I'm always fascinated, because there are those who are very quick decision makers. Give me the information. I've taken that in. I know what I want, and I'm ready to move, and they make that decision. And then there are others who will call us months in advance. Maybe they're doing preliminary budget work. You know, maybe they're just being more cautious, and they're asking more questions. And what's interesting is there is no formula for VC-backed does better or cautious does better. I've seen them all succeed in various ways. And you would think that the VC-backed ones might be the ones that are of the decision-making mindset, that they'll move quickly, but not always. So they may have ample funds, and therefore they have ample advisors, but they may take quite many more months than some others. There isn't one template. You can do it regardless of whether you have tons of money or not so much money, whether you have a US client or you don't, whether you have three employees in your home country or 100. There's no exact footprint, and there's no style of entrepreneur that means you're going to make it or not. There's just finding the trusted partners. I think also having yourself sort of organized at home, in your home country, who is leading the U.S. expansion, and recognizing that it is going to take time for a number of different employees, your accounting, your HR, your leadership, your business development, all of those people are going to be involved in that expansion. So when you've got your house in order in your home country, that's when, for me, it's time for someone to go, one of the hallmarks of readiness is that they have things organized at home. But many, many different styles and ways to be successful.
Mm-hmm. So maybe here in as the last question for you, is there something about America that Europeans don't know?
Oh, goodness. Well, I've talked a lot about stereotypes.
Yeah.
And, the American work culture is this, or Americans want that. And and of course, that's never true. If you take any population of people and, make generalizations, it's not true. So I think sometimes what catches people off guard, what they don't necessarily know about America, is how diverse it is within. So culture within different regions, even if you were to talk political divides, you can see that that's going to have an impact on mentality, expectations. It's as if an American entrepreneur were to say, I'm expanding to Europe. And what do you know about Europe? Well, they have the euro, and they have a lot of days of vacation, and they many of them know a lot of languages, and there's the European Union, so they all trade really easily with each other. That may be a perception that an uninformed American business person may have. So entrepreneurs in Europe may not realize just how diverse and segmented the U.S. is at many, many levels.
So to what degree do you think that a European tech startup wants to expand to the U.S.? To what degree do they need help?
Good question. So, of course, I'm with the work that Foothold America does, where it's related to employment, for sure. That's an area where I think you don't want to make mistakes, because the fines and taxes are very important to get right. And as I've said before, tax. So that's one example of tax, but there are many. So and there's legal advice as well, but I think you have to go with legal advice. Let me say this a different way. You don't have to have legal advice for everything. So there are setting up the U.S. entity, for example. You don't have to have a law firm do that. You probably don't want to do it yourself. You want to have a service, someone that does that on a regular basis, do that for you, because it's so fundamental and you don't want to mess it up. So there are just some fundamental things that you want to do properly. And of course, if you are sending a team, so some people will, you know, want to have a key person become a resident of the U.S., then there's immigration. I would never do immigration on my own. That might be because I personally messed up an application once, and it was a very costly error. I also don't color my hair on my own. So. But those key obvious things. So legal, tax, immigration, employment. But there are many other things that you you can do on your own. And you don't have to have the top four accounting firm or legal advice for every single thing. You know, some of the contracts, for example, you'll want to have a U.S. attorney review your contracts when you're converting over from another country.
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure hearing your thoughts. Really interesting. One thing that journalists, they always do in the end, they always ask if you have like any concluding remarks.
I just would like to thank you for having me here. We've talked about a lot of different things, and I've hoped that I've been able to communicate that it's both complex and needs your attention, but also very manageable and something that you should be excited about and believe in your heart that you can do.
Perfect. You know, that is exactly the reason journalists do that, because then it gets you to summarize the entire discussion in your own words. It's perfect.
Well, good. I hope you can find some useful information you won't have to edit too much.
But, no.
It's been my pleasure. And so thank you.
Thank you so much for participating. It's been a real pleasure. So this is a conversation I had with Joanne. I hope you enjoyed it and that you learned something from it. If you want to have more information, please go to contractbook.com/blog and read more articles about U.S. expansion. Yeah, thank you all for listening. Let's take the jingle just one more last time. Thank you.